Telecast.
Hi, I'm Justin Crosby, and welcome to another Telecast. We're in Cannes this week for one last hurrah at MIPTV. My guests are X-Files and Man in the High Castle screenwriter and CEO of Big Light Productions, Frank Spotnitz, Virginia Musilaire from The Wit, Garrett Goodman from AI dubbing business Papercup, Gaggle's Greg Mile, and RX Global's Lucy Smith gives us the lowdown on MIP London. It's all coming up on this week's Telecast.
So welcome to Cannes, where we're at MIPTV, and I'm here with award-winning producer and screenwriter and CEO of Big Light Productions, Frank Spotnitz. How are you doing, Frank?
Very good. Thanks for having me.
Lovely to see you here on the Riviera, enjoying the last of the sun before, I think you're on your way to the airport, aren't
you? I am, but it could not be a nicer day here. Just gorgeous.
Perfect. So we've got a lot to talk about. I want to talk about the X-Files, of course, and lots of the other major productions that you've been involved with over your career. But let's start at the beginning in terms of how you got into the industry, first of all. That's what I ask a lot of our guests, you know, is like how they got their break and how they got into the industry. And obviously, The X-Files was one of your first big hits, right? And one of the first productions that you were involved with. So tell me how that came about, first of all.
So incredibly, The X-Files was actually my first job. But it was very delayed. I grew up loving movies and TV, really obsessively watching movies and TV. I'd go to the same movie and see it two or three times in a row all day just to see what I could get out of it from a repeated viewing.
Yeah.
And I went to UCLA to study film and television. But then I had a family tragedy. One of my brothers died.
Oh.
And it just did something to my confidence. And I just turned away from it. I just felt like it wasn't possible for some reason. And I ended up being a reporter instead on the school newspaper. And then I worked as a journalist, a wire service reporter in Indiana, New York, and Paris throughout my 20s for 7 years. And I covered everything, fires, politics, you name it, and I covered it. And after 7 years of doing that, I just said, you know, I got to go back.
So finished business.
Yeah, So at the age of 29, I moved back from Paris to Los Angeles to go to film school, the American Film Institute, graduated at 31, and at 33, got my first job as a staff writer on The X-Files. And it was a late start, but it was the perfect show for me. It was a very tough, competitive environment. Chris Carter, who created the show, was brilliant and very, very demanding. And most people who came on that show did not last. And I was so green. I knew nothing, really, looking back on it. But somehow, because it was the right show for me, it was exactly what I would have watched as a kid. I just connected with it really quickly, and Chris saw that I connected with it. And so I went from staff writer, which is kind of the bottom rung, to executive producer, which is the top rung, in 3 years. I jumped up like 7 steps in 3 years.
Wow.
And became the president of Chris's company, did the show for 8 years, did both movies with Chris. And it was just, you know, one of the greatest gifts of my life. And an education. It was like my second film school, because you had to do 24 episodes a year. Like, that's a lot of TV. And you learn so fast, you have to. It's sink or swim. And so my storytelling muscles and my producing muscles got, you know, a lot stronger very quickly.
And I guess you must have learned about resilience, right, at that point, because, you know, as you said, high-pressure environment, but perfect learning slopes, if you like, to gain forward.
Yeah, I really felt like I just would not fail. I could not allow myself to fail. And I had plenty to learn in every way, but the thing I was not prepared for was sort of the politics of television, the politics of a TV show, of a studio, and
oh, yeah.
I was so naive, but I pulled through it. And I'm just so grateful for it. Still, obviously, you know, X-Files comes up almost every day. Still, almost every day, I meet people, and people still talk about it. It's been 30 years.
That's right.
This September is 30 years since the show began.
And there's talk about a second reboot right now. Do you know anything about that?
Only what Chris has told me and has said in the press. You know, I don't think Disney has announced it yet.
Right.
I'm not sure he's supposed to be talking about it, to be honest. But what he's talked about is that Ryan Coogler might do a reboot or a reimagining of it with, and obviously we're all huge fans of Ryan Coogler, so I'd be very excited to see what he comes up with.
Yeah.
I personally would be very nervous to take that assignment, not just because the original show was good, but because of David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson and their incredible chemistry. And I just think, I don't think you can compete with that. So if I were him, my advice would be go as far away from that as you possibly can, because I wouldn't, anybody who has to be compared to the two of them, it would be pretty daunting.
Right. Okay. So you don't think they would be attached? I mean, I think Gillian Anderson has talked about maybe she'd be open to it, or, you know.
I saw this interview. It was on the Today Show last week. And under questioning, she said what I said. Like, she's a big fan of his, and she might be open to sort of making some kind of an appearance in the show.
Right.
So, which I'm sure is true. Yeah. She probably would be open to doing that. But no, I think it's going to be a new cast.
All right. So, The X-Files, how many years were you involved then on the X-Files?
I came in early in season 2 and stayed to the end of season 9. And then I did both movies. I wasn't in the reboot that they did, the sort of short 2-season reboot. I was doing Man in the High Castle at the time.
Right. Okay. And was that your next major project after X-Files? Was that Man in the High Castle?
No. So I did a show with Michael Mann immediately after the X-Files, which was a really interesting experience. It was the first use of digital cameras for a television series ever, for a dramatic television series. And looking back on it, I realized it was his laboratory for the movie Collateral, the Tom Cruise movie, Jamie Foxx. He used a lot of the same locations, same kinds of cameras, a lot of the same actors that we used in Robert and Homicide Division. And then I did a reboot of The Night Stalker, which is one of my favorite shows as a kid, the Darren McGavin series and TV movies. And then I went to London in 2010 to do a spy series called Hunted for the BBC and Cinemax. This is a long story, but I ended up doing Strike Back as well when I got to London. And then after Hunted ended, after 2 years, no one in my family wanted to go back to Los Angeles. So that's why I'm sitting here talking to you, because I wanted to stay too, but to do that, you know, in Hollywood, you're a writer-producer, you're what they call a showrunner. That really isn't a thing here. There's a couple, but it's not really the way the business works in the UK or in Europe. So I didn't want to stop being a showrunner. So I started my company, Big Light Productions. It's been almost 11 years now, as a way to stay here and to employ myself and work the way I wanted to work. It was very busy out of the gate. There was a wave of co-productions happening then. It's happening again now. And after, I guess, 5 or 6 years, I started to realize, you know, this company could actually exist for other people besides me. And now, very robust slate of projects. I'd say probably 90% of them are written by other people, not me. I still write every day. I work as hard as a writer as I've ever worked, but I'm able to work with a lot of younger writers, a lot of diverse writers, and kind of use my experience to hopefully give, you know, more opportunity to other people.
So how did your experience on The X-Files, you know, and those learning slips we talked about, how's that influenced the way that you manage your business? Because you've got a lot of young writers working for you. And are you tough on them? Are you demanding?
I think I am very demanding, but in a very kind, respectful way. I feel like I'm not doing you a favor if I don't demand the best you have to get. In fact, I'm doing the opposite. I'm really hurting you. You need somebody, if you're a young writer or any writer, I need this. Somebody who's going to say, you know, that could be better. You could do that better. To the best of my ability, that's what I'm trying to do. But in a way that's supportive and respectful. Like, I know how hard it is to write or to direct or to act, any of those things. But I think we're all here to do good work. And, you know, I learned long ago in my career that you can get distracted by so many things in this business. You look at how much money somebody else is making, or the reviews they're getting, or the awards, or the audience ratings they're getting. It's actually not about that. All of that is noise. And you do yourself a disservice if you get confused by all that stuff. The only reason you're here is to do good work. The only reason I'm here is because when I was a kid, I loved these movies and TV shows so much. And I want to make shows and movies that people love, like I love the ones that I watched. You know, that's the joy of this. And so I'm for whatever leads to good work. And whenever there's a problem that arises or a question, I just ask myself, will this lead to good work? And if it won't, I'm against it. I'm pretty fiercely against it. Like, I think I'm a pretty nice guy. But when it comes to that, I'll be as tough as I need to be to defend. Otherwise, why are we here? You know, we're kind of hurting everybody, and the audience isn't going to like it. So that's sort of like my North Star is doing good work. But specifically what I learned from The X-Files, I learned the value of ambition, of aiming really high, of every time giving 110%, make it as good as you could possibly be. and of never underestimating the audience. No matter how smart you think you are, the audience is always smarter. The only advantage we have is we can spend the time being smart. You know, we can spend, I remember Vince Gilligan, who's my friend from X-Files days, saying there was a scene in Breaking Bad where, you know, Walt and Jesse were locked in the RV and Hank is knocking on the door and they were like, how are we going to get Hank away from that RV? And it took them a week in the writer's room to come up with how they got him away, which was a call from the hospital that is what. And that's the advantage we have. You've spent a week working, your characters can be smarter than you are. You know, so it's that work ethic. But the other thing, I'm sorry, this is a long answer, but what you realize in Hollywood when you have writer's rooms is the value of collaboration. And that's something that I evangelize a lot here in Europe. It's about writer's rooms and collaboration and this idea that the work is greater than you, that all of us, writers, directors, producers, actors, are here to serve the work. And that's a radical thing to say to a lot of people. But I believe that in my bones, that's what we should all embrace.
And you talked about politics of TV, and particularly in drama, yeah. I think there's a lot of politics, there's a lot of egos, there's a lot of people to keep on side and get ideas through, or, you know, you're the cross. Do you think that's changed in any way over the years, or do you think it's more of a challenge than ever now?
I think it's just human nature. It's always going to be treacherous to an extent, and I think I work very hard to try and make sure the partners I'm working with are people whose heart is in the right place and who have the same values that I do. Every once in a while you make a mistake, but even with people whose heart is in the right place, you know, fear is a big thing in this business because what we do is so subjective. You know, I remember the first time I wrote a script as opposed to journalism, I felt so naked and exposed because with journalism, I could always say, well, they said this, I'm reporting on what they did. I'm just, it's not me, it's them. But when it was my script, it was just me.
It's like your imagination.
Yeah. And people are reading it going, you know, you think that's good? You thought that was, you know, funny or scary or whatever. It's like, well, yeah, I kind of did, or I literally did it. So I totally get the fear. And I think a lot of, like, when they say there's a difficult actor or something, they're not. It's fear. They're afraid they're not going to be good. They're afraid the work's not going to be good. And so I have a lot of sympathy for that. And I want to listen to them and help them regain the confidence. And the same goes for directors, producers. I think a lot of what you do as a lead writer, producer, is try to make sure that we all are telling the same story, or we're all marching in the same direction. And then you're more likely to succeed. I mean, it's so hard. So many things have to go right to really make something great, you know? But it begins with having the ambition to make something great, you know? Yeah. And I always say, I've been teaching now in Berlin this is my 11th year I've been teaching. And I always say, you know, aim here, like aim for the stars. Every time I write something, I'm thinking, this is going to be one of the greatest things ever. Really, I'm not kidding. I really think that. And then of course, I'm aiming there, and if I'm really lucky, it's going to probably land here. You know, it's pretty good. But if I start out aiming at that, which is, you know, it's going to be as good as that show, you know, that kind of, which you hear from a lot of people, you know, it'll be better than that. But, you know, that's not a very great ambition. And then guess where you'll land? Not in a place you want to be. And so I always say, like, aim as high as you can. Hopefully, there's not one thing I've done in my career where I feel like that's as good as I wanted it.
So, well, let's talk about some of these projects you've been instrumental in. So we've got Man in the High Castle, we talked about, which was a huge hit on Amazon, wasn't it, a few years ago. Medici the Magnificent, Medici, Masters of Florence, Ransom, The Indian Detective, Millennium, Lone Gunman, Night Stalker, Hunted, you talked about those. I mean, extraordinary amount of television that you've been, as I say, instrumental in. Any of those projects stick out to you to be what you feel is your best work, or perhaps have learned the most from? Or
it's a funny thing. To me, it's like looking at your children. You know, it's like I loved each one of them, you know, and I put my heart and soul into it. I can't fake it. I really loved it, and I did my best. And then sometimes, for some reason, something clicks with people. Like Man in the High Castle, I had no idea. The pilot was done. We edited. We were delivering on the service. If you had told me that was a bomb, okay. And instead it was, I think, by a factor of five, the biggest hit Amazon had ever had at that point. And then a show like The Lone Gunman, which was a spinoff of The X-Files, I couldn't have loved that show more. I still could not love that show more. Why? Looking back, I think, well, it was kind of late in the run of The X-Files. But You know, I loved it. So I think the experiences, the shows that I look back with less fondness, it's not that I didn't love the show. It's that the politics of the show or the people involved made it very hard for me to do good work. And so it was like painful. That's happened more than a few times.
Right.
Where it's like, ugh, you know, it just...
Do you see yourself as a bit of a politician, though? Because you've got to be a little bit, right?
You know, I think a good producer is a bit of a politician, that you have to have a lot of emotional intelligence to understand where the people are coming from. Like I was talking about actors with their fear. And a really good producer will avert a problem before it even occurs. They'll see it coming, and they'll take action to make sure it doesn't even happen first. And that's one of the benefits of experience, you know, and if you are... And I've gotten more emotionally intelligent, you know, as time has gone on. That's one of the benefits of age, of having more experience. Yeah, you don't want the drama off screen. You want the drama on screen, and you want everybody marching in the same direction, and you don't want unnecessary conflicts. You know, some conflicts are really constructive and lead to a better show. Like sometimes you have a debate about script or casting or whatever, it's healthy. But a lot of conflicts are just destructive and don't help you get where you want to get, which is doing good work.
So we're here at MIT TV where buying and selling of TV goes on. And we're seeing now probably the biggest crisis that the TV industry has faced, certainly since 2008.
I'd say ever, yeah.
Yeah. And we all know why that is. Money just isn't coming to the industry through advertising, and also post-pandemic gold rushes is abated now. How are you seeing it from a Big Light perspective? Because presumably a lot of your shows are big budget in their very nature. Mm-hmm. They are ambitious and stories and need big budgets to carry them off. I mean, how are you seeing the market right now?
It's a very funny thing, because when I first told people I was moving to Europe, I was staying in London, people in LA looked at me like, are you crazy? Like, what are you doing? Because, you know, LA was like the center of the universe. And back then, it just seemed like exceedingly strange, not self-destructive, to come work in Europe. And now I look like a genius, because in LA right now, it's very, very dire. It's very grim in the state of the TV business, because that's the epicenter, you know. All the traditional studios, belatedly, we're talking like 5 years ago, decided to follow Netflix into the streaming platform business and basically cut off all their other forms of revenue, you know, the resale of their shows to other buyers in favor of a subscription model that simply did not generate enough revenue to support the billions of dollars they're investing in programming.
Well, they weren't consumer companies, right? And they went from overnight from being a B2B company to a B2C, very different model, huge implications on cost. And now we're seeing all of that slowing down.
Yeah. And the money they spent on those shows. And you're right. I've done a lot of big budget shows, but I was appalled. I mean, I did interviews where I said this publicly. This is crazy. You shouldn't be spending this money. TV does not need to cost as much as they've spent on shows that there's no rational world where that show should cost that much. And then to have them turn around and tell the writers we can't afford to pay you, or the actor, it's like, after you just spend $500 million on that show that nobody's going to watch, like, you can't do that. Here in Europe, they can say a big budget show, like I do a big budget show, $3 million an hour. That's a big budget in Europe, right? In America, you can't do a show for $3 million an hour, right? But here, the crews are smaller. And here, people get paid less. And here, the production value, just look around where you are, is astonishing. Like a show like The Medici or Leonardo or Devils, you know, these other shows I've done in Italy. So while things are dire and I feel terrible about what's happened in Los Angeles, and so many of my friends are really suffering right now, you know, who have not worked, not just writers and editors and actors and directors, but, you know, people in crews and people who support the industry are all suffering.
We've obviously had the writer's strike and the strikes that have gone on. So that's even exacerbated the problem.
Absolutely. And I think we all sort of thought, well, once the strikes are over, we'll get back to work. And it just has not happened. I do think things are going to get better. But in Europe, things are down. But it's not like that. Things are down, you know, advertising down 5 to 8%. And we've lost a lot of the streaming money that was coming here has been lost. But the truth is, the traditional broadcasters still make something like three times as many shows as the streamers make. not at the budget levels, but nonetheless, it's work for all the producers and all the actors and directors. So this is actually a relatively good place to be during a storm. It's still a storm. It's not like we're having a ball over here either. And the fact that, you know, when we make shows here, we want to sell them back to the U.S. That's still the biggest market for shows. And that they're not buying much either hurts us as well. But it's relatively better to be here right now. Having said all that, I do feel like we're nearly at the bottom of this, that now you're going to start to see that the companies that survive are going to start to rebuild their business. And it's going to be a much more rational, sustainable model than what we've just seen. And that's a good thing. And also, I think what's interesting is it's not purely going to be a subscription-based business anymore because they have advertising tiers. Now, to me, advertising is a much better metric of success for your show than subscriptions. Because advertising is literally how many people are watching your show, not how many subscriptions will it sell. Like a show like Man in the High Castle, you knew it was never going to go longer than four seasons because you're going to top out on the number of subscribers it's going to draw. And so it's going to die. But if there's advertising and you're making money off of advertising revenue, well, now you're back to the way TV used to be, which is shows can go on and on and on. As long as advertisers are willing to advertise on those shows, it's a better way to fund television. So it's going to take a little while for all of that to set in. But I think if we talk, you know, a year from now, it's going to be a lot better picture than it is now.
One of the other, I can't talk to a writer without talking about AI, of course.
Yes.
Do you use it internally?
Every day, as much as I can. I am really excited about AI. I wish it was as advanced as people like to think it is. It's not. I know because I use it so much. I love it. I think it's great. I use it for research.
Like, what do you use?
I use Perplexity. I've used Bing. I've used Gemini. I try them all out and I compare them to see the kind of answers I get. But, you know, what I find is that things that I didn't know, and so I would guess at, or if I needed to know it, I would spend an hour or two on Google looking for the information I wanted. Now I simply type in a question, and there's the answer, exactly what I need to know, you know, for research for my script. And again, it's kind of wonky still, but what's good is some of these apps have footnotes, and you can check the information and see where it came from and make sure it's correct information. But it's still pretty, I expect that too is going to get a lot better pretty quickly. Everybody I know, believe me, everybody's terrified. Writers, directors, editors, not actors so much. Well, actors are worried about other implications going on. But we need to embrace this, you know. We want the creative people to be the ones figuring out how we make this tool work for us as artists. We don't want the corporations telling us how it's going to work for them profit-wise, financially. That will be a disaster. Because I can tell you already, there are people out there thinking, AI is a hammer, we can fire all the carpenters. It's like, no, dude, you still need the carpenter to use the hammer. AI is a hammer. It's a tool. We're the artists. We're going to stay the artists. There's a lot of work that now can be done a lot faster. And there will be some job loss, I'm sure. But the jobs that remain are going to be superpowered. It's going to grow and be a great asset. But I just plead with people in the creative community, use the tool. Figure it out. Let's tell the money people how we're using it. Let's let it make our lives better. Because if we don't, it's going to make our lives worse.
And let's talk about Big Light. Tell us what you've got in development. Certain things you can't tell me, I'm sure. Yeah. But there may be some things that you can tell me about what you're working on now, what ambitions are for the next couple of years in terms of projects.
Well, we're a very unusual company because I'm a writer and I'm an American writer heading up a British production company. It's a very odd situation. And so I've always been kind of driven by, you know, a writer's passions. And I love all kinds of stories. I love all kinds of genres. I think back to the shows that I loved when I was a kid. And I loved everything, to be fair. I watched everything indiscriminately. But the ones that really stuck with me, like, you know, Star Trek or The Twilight Zone or Outer Limits, these shows were about something. You know, they were really entertaining. But they also asked questions and made you think. And they're TV that has stayed with me my entire life. And how many shows can you say that about, really? I mean, I love TV, but a lot of TV is kind of just in and out. And especially now when there's been such a barrage of TV, it's hard to even remember sometimes what I saw last week. And I've never wanted to make TV like that. I've always wanted to make TV that sticks with me, that I'm glad I watched, that made me think. It's like really good TV or storytelling is like, it enriches your life. It gives you an understanding of other people and things that you wouldn't have had if you hadn't seen that show. It doesn't have to be a drama. It could be a silly comedy. It could be anything. But I look for things that have that quality. So my slate has a wide variety of genres, but I think they all have that the potential to be great, to be something you remember for a long time. We do shows with the UK, we have shows with the BBC. We do lots of stuff with the US, obviously, because I'm American, streaming platforms. But I think what's most unusual about us as a British production company is we really lean into Europe in a way that very few British producers do. So we've done shows with the French. We're doing a show this year, hopefully in Scandinavia as well, and other countries as well. Like I love the adventure of that. The stimulation of it and understanding of the culture. And it's just a great gift being here in Europe, being exposed to all these cultures.
And you talking about co-productions mainly?
These are all co-productions. So we have one that was just announced at Series Mania 2 weeks ago. And it's got this brilliant director who did 3 seasons of The Crown, and Christian Schraughoff, I know what I'm saying, is certainly correctly, about the Nuremberg Nazi trials. And it's a deeply entertaining show. I mean, you might hear Nuremberg and go, wow, Nuremberg. And I'm not saying it's not heavy in a lot of ways, obviously, dealing with Nazis and the crimes the Nazis committed. But it's also a show that, I think you'll want to, people will want to watch. You'll be excited to watch the next one. And I'm really excited to do that. And that's in general the show that I think has something to say. That doesn't tell you what to think, but just asks you questions.
And now it's time for Story of the Week, where Frank gets to nominate the TV industry news story that caught his eye in the past 7 days. Frank, tell us what your story is.
Well, you were asking about AI earlier, and I saw a story, a New York Times reporter was speaking to an artist and filmmaker called Paul Trillo. And Sora, which you're familiar with, which is the new image creation, artificial intelligence, invited a number of artists to make short films using AI. And Paul Trillo made a short film called The Golden Record, which you can see on Vimeo. It's quite beautiful. But I thought what was really heartening about what he had to say was that it is just a tool. Like, he did not feel disempowered by it at all. Quite the opposite. He felt very empowered by it and was able to do something relatively quickly that he could not have done. And he's still the human being, still the human artist at the center of that process. And he talked about how many thousands of decisions go into filmmaking. Every second is another human decision. So to me, that was it's actually a really important story for people to hear, because I think the number one thing we have to be afraid of is fear. Yeah. And I thought that was a great example and story that tells us why we shouldn't be afraid.
And now it's time for Hero of the Week. Frank, who's your hero of the week?
So I talked about how TV inspired me as a child, and I'd say the most important show for me was The Twilight Zone. And its creator, Rod Serling, would be 100 years old this year. December 24th, it would be his 100th birthday. And The Twilight Zone will be 65 years old this year. I would argue, I know there's a number of nominees for this, but he's the most important television writer of all time. He wrote really hard, beautiful social dramas for live television in the 50s, got tired of battling censorship, and then decided he was going to do a show called The Twilight Zone. It was just fantasy. And of course, he said so many powerful things through the parables that he wrote in The Twilight Zone. And I think if you were to ask, all the storytellers working in television today, certainly in the U.S., there is no show you would hear mentioned more often in The Twilight Zone. So I'm grateful for this opportunity to sort of celebrate Rod Serling.
And what's your favorite episode of Twilight Zone then?
Time Enough at Last, probably, which is the great Burgess Meredith episode where he's the bank teller who just wants time to read. If you remember that one, but that's unbelievable. Eye of the Beholder is another great one.
Right. Which is the one with the an ape on the wing of the airplane?
Yes, that's Terror 40,000 Feet, I think.
Yeah.
That's the one with William Shatner.
That's William Shatner. That's
yes.
Right. That still sticks with me when I first saw that show. That
honestly, there's 50 episodes I could name, but and they're just perfect. They're just perfect. And very hard to replicate. They've tried over the years. There have been different reboots to the Jordan Peele one just a couple of years ago, but there was something about those original episodes that's impossible to beat.
And how about Get in the Bin? Who or what are you telling to get in the bin, Frank?
Well, it's not really a TV story, but it affects all of us. I was reading a story this week about wealth inequality. And it's not just in the U.S., but here in Europe, too, how, you know, a handful of people have as much wealth as the rest of the population combined. And I look around the world at, you know, these authoritarian movements and rising fascism and all the instability and the hate and the polarization we see. And I think that is one of the root causes, if not the biggest root cause. It's just this sense of unfairness, fundamental unfairness in society, and that democratic governments, even the best and most well-intentioned democratic governments, are doing nothing to fix the problem. So, you know, I know we're in the TV business, but all the TV writers, directors, producers I speak to, we talk about this all the time, about the world we're living in and the unease we all feel.
So a sense of hopelessness, really, and an inability to affect actually what's going on.
Yeah. And, you know, we are storytellers. We're not propagandists. You know, we can't make political tracks telling people vote this way or do that. We just, like I said, we just ask questions. But you have this sense that, you know, it's a slow-moving catastrophe. We all feel it. And I think we need to start to figure out ways to do something about it.
Frank, it's been an absolute pleasure to meet you. Thank you for taking time out.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, well, I hope we can speak again one day.
Me too.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So I'm here with Virginia Muselet from TV trends and analysis business, The Wit, here at MIPTV. How are you doing, Virginia?
Very well, Justin, and I'm very happy to see you.
Me too. Yeah, it was great to see you last time we spoke. Obviously, was MIPCOM.
Yes.
And this is becoming our now traditional chat, I think, at in Cannes.
Yeah.
Really enjoyed your session that you've just presented,
which was called
Fresh Garden. And it's all about the creator economy and content creators and providing really inspiration and insights for the TV industry. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting to see that the way that the creator economy and the TV industry is starting to merge. And your jumping off point, I think, really was obviously the very well publicized Mr. Beast and Amazon Prime announcement. But you started to go into depth on the types of shows that are becoming popular for content creators and perhaps some inspiration for TV producers in the more traditional area. First of all, tell us a little bit about the successful content creators and what you're seeing, because I thought scale was an important aspect of that, wasn't it? You know, the way that content creators do it bigger and better almost with tiny budgets. But yeah, tell us a little bit about scale and the success of Mr. Beast.
Yes, we started this presentation with this announcement from Mr. Beast. And that is preparing the biggest ever game show on TV. And we try to compare what is a format for Mr. Beast and what is a format for TV. And we find a couple of items to compare. And the first one is the scale. For Mr. Beast, if you see all his thumbnails, it's always extreme challenges. It's with a limited time, one day for 1,000 person to take on a challenge, or one day, 100 dogs to rescue in a day and have adopted. And actually, on the comparison, a format, it has to be scalable. For Mr. Beast, it's one idea, one episode, you know, 10 minutes, 20 minutes at the maximum. The format is interesting when you can scale it, you can adapt it to smaller budgets, smaller broadcasters. So this is a big difference. And maybe Mr. Beast is going to evolve, because he says that he's slowing the pace of his episodes. Maybe sometimes he's doing limited series, not just one. And of course, for a TV format, it's better to have one idea, 100 episodes, one set, 100 episodes, and that lasts for years. And also for Mr. Beast, it's a huge budget for TV. Sometimes you have to have a smaller budget with the same idea, bigger, you know. So, and also thinking of, in my Fresh Format conference, also there is a bridge between the reflections that were inspired by Mr. Beast and the TV formats, we found out, and everybody say that there is not a tremendous activity in the format business, in creativity. But in a way, we wanted to see in the grids if it's real, if it's true that they're always the same format. If there is a kind of stickiness, we call that the stickiness index, because everybody complains the broadcaster do not buy new ideas, new formats. Is it true that the grids are always the same and it's sticky? And we found out that actually in daytime and prime time, and it's not very different. Even if you distinguish the two slots, there is approximately 51% or 52% of new titles in the grid, less than 5 years old, and 49 of more than over 5 years old. More than 20 years old, it's approximately 12% of the grid. So in a way, half of the shows that you can see on the grids of the main broadcasters, Western broadcasters, it's 52 of new titles that are less than 5 years old.
Okay, well, that's interesting, so, and that gives hope, I think, to a lot of format developers.
Absolutely, and also what is very interesting is we compared which country is the freshest one with new titles, and which one is the stickiest. And it's funny because the freshest one, we found out it was the Netherlands, because, of course, everybody knows they're very creative and they're inventing a lot of new formats.
The cradle of the format
exactly.
industry.
Yeah. We took entertainment, game shows and factual entertainment. I mean, and the other country that is very creative, and it's the UK. But actually, the UK is the stickiest because of all the daytime formats that are there for years and years, dozens of years. And it's funny because the two most creative countries, their grids are one of the less sticky and the freshest, and the other one, the UK, is the stickiest.
Very interesting. Talking about older formats, in your presentation, you also highlighted creators that are recreating TV formats on streaming services often. So I think Twitch seems to be very popular, particularly in Germany, for, I think it was Dancing with the Stars and also a Big Brother adaptation that's been very popular. We're also seeing a bit of nostalgia in a way for the YouTube generation and the Twitch generation looking for their heroes, their YouTube stars to be on these established TV shows that maybe hark back a few years.
Yes, it's what you see is there are very different sources of inspiration for the YouTubers. And first, it's always around the personality. So also compared with the format, it's you have personality shows on TV, but they can't be adapted in another country. But when content creators want to invent a new show, very often their inspiration comes from TV formats, from the very basic one, like Name That Tune or Guessing Games. So in a way, it's like counterintuitive, because I always thought at the WIT when we wanted to look for really creative, innovative ideas, we were looking in YouTube. But actually, in YouTube, what you find is very simple guessing game or a musical-based guessing game or whatever. But there are not revolutionary concepts that you bring to TV. It's actually a TV on a different platform with different characters. YouTubers try to, in a way, to make TV-like shows with high production values, slower pace, and on Twitch, you have the episodes are 30 or 50 minutes for, Big Brother. But instead of being, 3 months in a house, they're only 57 hours. So it's really, we don't know really where it will end, all this inspiration. But it's really an exchange of inspiration, of creation, but also an exchange of consumption for the content.
And we saw lots of brands as well that are creating their own series, their own quiz shows. You shared the example of JD Sports in the UK, with a very straightforward quiz show. We've also seen a lot of brands being adapted, like The Chase was adapted by The Sidemen relatively recently. But we've seen lots of new original format ideas that have been developed by stars such as Gordon Ramsay. Really interesting to see these new formats that are being developed by talent they've already got, you know, huge audiences, and using that for brands to fund their new original content.
Yes, because the funding or financing problem in TV, and with all the regulation that limits, you know, the brands to be present, in a way, that is still a space for freedom, you know, the digital space. And in a way, you have to create where the money is. And even if it's not, in a way, a creative freedom space or an innovating creative space, the digital space, at least it's a space where you can bring money that you can't expose on television. And maybe precisely it's the content creator economy will merge or will bring to TV new ways of financing show to stimulate creativity.
Very interesting. Thank you very much, Virginia. It was really fascinating. Lovely to see you again.
Thank you.
I'll look forward to your other sessions, not only at MIP TV, but other events as well. So thank you.
Thank you. Just have a nice time in Cannes for the last time and enjoy the sun.
I will indeed. I'll try my hardest. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
My next guest on this week's MIP TV special is Greg Mile from Gaggle. How are you doing, Greg?
Good, Justin. Great to meet you.
You too. So tell us about Gaggle, because it's an interesting business at the sort of intersection of social media and TV and content, which is something that we always like to talk about on the show. So tell me about your business.
So this is a business we've just launched, and we've announced it at MIP TV today. It's TV meets the creator economy. So we're taking TV content and bringing it to social media, broadcasting it via influencers, having made the content interactive, and then broadcasting on Twitch, YouTube Live, in a live interactive format.
So this is really interesting. It's sort of almost media eating itself to a certain extent. So tell me in practice how that works. So you're working with producers, presumably, and you're repurposing content. Just talk us through that.
So Fremantle in the US has been our test partner. Our first show is The Price is Right. So The Price is Right, for obviously in the TV world, is huge, but it's the number one game show globally. It's in 65 countries. We've taken library content from The Price is Right, the 1972 Bob Barker edition. We've made the shows fully interactive so people can play along. And then we broadcast the shows via a series of creators. So they're all broadcasting the same show at different times to their audience. And it's a 25-minute show. The broadcast with the influencers is probably 45 minutes on average. And so they're hosting the show, they're commenting on the show, and then every so often the show will pause and the audience is asked to play along with the questions that the studio audience and the contestants have already done.
That's really interesting. So it's kind of watch along, right? Along and play along as well.
Yes, exactly. For years people have shouted at the TV, now the TV can shout back.
And so I'm assuming that most of the content that you're going to be looking at is going to be game show content, is that right?
We've started with game shows because it's the easiest format both to make interactive and because there's actually a huge amount of those shows. And they never really can be broadcast again, right? You never take a game show you've already broadcast and broadcast it again on linear TV. It doesn't really make sense. So we started with that, but we're moving into scripted youth drama and non-scripted as well.
So much of this content will presumably already be available on like fast channels, for example. So there's no exclusivity. This is all about repurposing library content, essentially. And tell me about the monetization model. Right?
So it's about opening a new distribution channel, right? And so as you know, what we've seen with digital disruption across many, many media, many, many industries in the media space, is that you move from a world where your monetization is kind of one main linear channel and maybe you can sell it into other countries, to a world where you've got to distribute across multiple digital platforms. So this is opening that new channel. The monetization is, of course, advertising. It's and it's on a rev share basis. And we're very clear on that. And the content owners are very, very happy with that. But we essentially, we take out the old ad breaks and we put in interactive advertising, which is something that we're going to be pioneering. So to give you an example, what was the price of a Pepsi in 1972? So the audience plays along, or you know, if you're playing something like Family Feud, known as Family Fortunes in the UK, take the same brand, Pepsi, and say, okay, you know, name a celebrity who has appeared in a Pepsi commercial at the Super Bowl. So you can use the advertising and the show to interact in a way which makes the advertising very interactive, and that commands obviously premium rates from advertisers.
And so tell me about the creators that you're working with. Presumably they need a certain level of scale and a following that they're interacting with already. So tell me about, you know, what's the threshold for working with creators?
So there's obviously a huge pyramid of creators. We only work with the very top ones, the ones that are Twitch premium partners. So they already work with major brands. They have a track record. They have a substantial following. And those are they're the brand safe creators. They're the ones who are used to doing this. They stream for 7 or 8 hours a day, and they are the ones who become the hosts.
And so why Twitch?
We started with Twitch because as a platform, it offers the most interactivity and it's just generally some of the best tech for this. We're going to be moving to YouTube Live at some point and extending to that. We're already in conversations about that. My co-founders, one was Twitch's global head of branded content up until we've started this, and the other one was the Twitch's head of production. So obviously we have a natural skill set also with Twitch.
And so you've just launched here at MIPTV, as you said, with a Fremantle test case. So what's next? What's the rollout of Gaggle?
So at the moment we're in the US and UK. It's pretty much at the moment a US-based proposition. It's obviously the biggest market, but we'll roll out across a number of other countries in due course. But this scales in four ways. So it scales by the number of shows that you broadcast. It scales by the number of creators per show. It scales by types of platform, and it scales by types of country. So there's the business goes in multiple directions, but we are already in deep conversations with most of the major content owners in both the US and UK.
And finally, you're starting out with game shows, as you said, huge catalogs and not really, you know, content that you can that has another life in other ways than this. So tell me about what are the genres that you're going to be moving into.
So it's very much youth orientated, right? What you're doing here from a strategic perspective, and if you think about the TV industry has lost had an incredible fall in 16 to 34 viewership. In the US, it's down by 2/3 in 5 years. There's incredible loss of an audience. And so what we're doing here is we're opening up like a third arm for the TV industry. So you've got linear as one group, SVOD and FAST as the second group, and then social media as the third group. So that then reflects into the TV shows that work in this kind of environment. It's got to be shows that appeal to a 16 to 34 audience. So if you think about that, game shows are universal and have this universal demand and desire, but scripted shows, there are lots and lots of classics that will be interesting to this group, and then some that just won't work. Right. So when we work with the content owners, they typically give us, we describe what we want, they give us a list of 20 shows that they think could work, and we're quite categorical that these shows will work and these shows kind of won't for this audience. So we've got your youth-focused drama, meme-focused drama. So one of the shows that should be coming up is The IT Crowd. Obviously very interesting to this group. There are some other ones that we haven't announced yet that are, let's say, iconic 90s and 2000s dramas.
Interesting. Greg, really interesting to hear about Gaggle. I wish you all the very best. And we'll keep our eyes out for further announcements with the business going forward.
Thanks, Justin. Great to speak to you.
So my next guest on this week's MIPTV special is Garrett Goodman from Papercup, AI dubbing company Papercup. How are you doing, Garrett?
Very good, thank you. Enjoying the sunshine.
Excellent. Well, that's what we're all doing out here. Beautiful town of Cannes in the background, and it's a nice place to be. So Papercup was a product that came to our attention recently during our roundup of the best AI tools for producers, which we looked at a few months ago. And first of all, I'd like to, you know, get an understanding from you about Papercup and who you are, what it is, and who it's of use for.
So we are AI dubbing, but with a twist, right? Most of the AI dubbing that's out there these days, the new companies that are emerging on the scene every week, it feels like, they are primarily automated solutions, whereas we're a hybrid. So we have award-winning AI dubbing that also gets perfected by human translators. So for us, the human in the loop is a really key component, how we achieve the quality that our clients are looking for.
Okay. And I mean, that's really interesting because I've tried AI dubbing tools and some of them just don't work, right? You know, I know that we're in a very early development of AI, essentially, and how that's helping. But having a human in the process, can you just explain that a little bit? Because obviously, well, tell us how AI works and how the human engineer works with that for your service.
Sure. So you can think about Google Translate, right? And over the years, it's gotten better and better, but it's still not perfect. And if you have a brand worth protecting, if you're a large distributor, or studio, broadcaster, and you want to just trust that AI is going to get it right, you have to have a pretty high appetite for risk. Or you end up investing internal resources to make sure it got it right and building out a localization team who's going to QA the translations and also make sure that the performance and the delivery is on point. Or you work with someone like us who has that built in to the process. So yes, we do our first pass with AI. And then we have professional translators who are going in and actually refining not just the translation, but they're acting like a dubbing director for our synthetic voices and dialing up and dialing down the emotion where it's needed so that the end performance feels really organic and expressive. That's our main focus, is expressivity.
Okay, so it's about the tone of the translation as well as just the accuracy of the language.
Yeah, so we have a belief that there are some fundamentals that you need to get right with synthetic speech, with AI dubbing, in order to really engage the audience. Like, it's one thing to have a Siri or an Alexa that sounds good for a 5-second utterance, but when we're talking 90-minute films, you need something beyond just a monotonous, disinterested voice, right? You need some variability in the delivery. So some of the fundamentals as we see it are things like the voice has to be easily understood. It has to be clear, right? The translation has to be accurate. And there needs to be a level of emotional depth to the delivery, or else you just end up losing the audience.
Yeah, well, I played about with a few text-to-speech and also speech-to-speech services, and they didn't really like my Yorkshire accent, or certainly they didn't replicate it very well. So in terms of AI dubbing and the human, does that make you more expensive than other AI-only services?
Sure. I mean, there are AI fully automated solutions out there that are completely free. So yeah, we're more expensive than free. Google Aloud, for example, has launched right within YouTube's ecosystem as a free service to dub some YouTube channels into other languages. And I think there's absolutely a place for that market. You know, if you're recording a podcast on your own thoughts on the last football match, then you're probably not going to invest in quality dubbing until you've built up a critical mass of audience to justify that. People who are using us have built up that critical mass of audience and know that it's a big risk if they marry their high quality content with low quality hit or miss automated dubbing from AI that's just not at that level. Like you said, it takes a lot of tweaking, right? If a Yorkshire accent comes in and you get something sort of garbled and weird coming out the other end, it's possible to bring that back to a good place, but it takes a lot of time and effort to do that. And most of these companies are looking at us to be a streamlined, simplified way to localize their content. And so they just externalize the whole flow to us, right? And in that way, it can be much more efficient, both cost efficient, cost-effective and more efficient for them operationally as well.
So I've heard various people talking about AI dubbing systems that work particularly well for some language into other languages.
Yeah, sure.
So just can you explain why that is the case? Why one service may be better, German to Portuguese, for example, another English to French? Can you just explain why that might be the case?
Yeah, well, a lot of it has to do with the data that it was trained on. There are different components in AI dubbing. One of them is the speech to text initially. So the accuracy of that translation is going to determine all of the next steps, right? The quality of that initial translation. Some systems are better at recognizing speech as actually training data in that language, right? So that's one component. And then the other, for us especially, is the human component of it, right? The human in the loop, the professional translators. So we start in English and we go into about 10 different languages. And that's really a deliberate limitation we've placed in order to make sure that we're scaling in the languages that have the most commercial viability for our customers. Because any new language that we jump into means that we are building out an army of professional translators to be able to QA that content. So whenever you see a solution purporting to go into 73 languages or 112 languages, 9 times out of 10, that's not their technology. They're pulling an off-the-shelf solution, a text-to-speech engine from one of the big boys like Amazon or Google or Microsoft. They all have text-to-speech engines, and they're plugging that in to their stack. And that's actually why we've seen this explosion of AI dubbing companies this last year, is because it's never been easier to just use other people's tech and only have to connect the pipes in order to say you do AI dubbing, which is very different from the way that we do it, which is actually we commission voice actors to come into a studio, we gather fresh data, and we build voices for video from real human voice actors. And so we have to be careful with where we, you know, deploy our resources, which leads to limitations in language. We feel confident that those are the right languages for our customers to be successful.
And so we're still relatively early in this AI journey when it comes to AI technology for TV producers and content creators. Where are we going with it? I mean, you know, where do you see Papercup being in a year, 18 months in terms of the services that you offer, and can you just talk us a little bit through that?
Yeah, so we kind of look at this in two different vectors of expansion. One being broadening the range of genres where our voices can really do justice to the source content. Currently, we're doing a lot of work in the factual space. We've just started working with one of the, we're doing stuff in kids now as well. But as our models mature and our voices can get even more expressive, that'll unlock more and more different kinds of content. So that's one vector of growth I see.
Are you talking there about actually synthetic acting?
Not so much synthetic actors. We'll stick to dubbing, but it'll be synthetic speech that sounds indistinguishable from a human performance on more kinds of content. The other vector that we look at is language expansion, obviously. Right? So I said we're in about 10 languages currently. We're continuing to add new languages. One of the fun things that we've been doing is actually making the voices that we've commissioned and built multilingual. Because when we do a commission for Arab-speaking voices, we're very careful about which new voices we add to our catalog, right? So we have, you know, a bank of voices available, and we'll actually do a casting with voice actors to see, oh, does this person fit the gap that we need to fill in our voice catalog? One of the big step changes that's already we've seen incredible results on and that we're about to deploy, you know, at scale, is the ability to take all of the voices we built for Arabic and all of the voices we built for Spanish and for French, and all of a sudden make all of them multilingual so they can speak any language, which will dramatically increase the voice catalog and improve our coverage.
Wow. Okay. Well, interesting times ahead. Gareth,
Harry,
thank you very much for joining us on Telecast, and good luck at Lip TV.
Thanks so much for having me.
So my final guest on this week's final MIP TV special edition of Telecast is Lucy Smith from RX Global. Lucy, lovely to see you.
Lovely to see you as well, Justin. Thanks for being here again.
Not at all. It's always a pleasure to come to Cannes. It's always a pleasure to come to MIP TV or MIPCOM. And we're bidding farewell, of course, to MIP TV.
Yeah, we are. So this is the 61st and final MIPTV. So it's a special MIPTV. It's quite an emotional MIPTV for many people. But it has gone extremely well. We kicked off over the weekend with the biggest weekend in Unscripted with MIPDoc and MIP formats, with really kind of packed houses in terms of the sessions, some of the highlights. We had a wonderful keynote from the great Dawn Porter for MIPDoc. And MIP formats, it's always a great opportunity to be able to see, you know, what's new, a lot of trend sessions, some brilliant new Korean content, I have to say, which I heard a lot of people talking about. And I think you can probably hear a bit in the background, there've been meetings going nonstop. And yesterday we kicked off the MIPTV program. We actually had an opening keynote from a kind of MIPTV veteran, but from a while ago, with Mark Endemagno, who's the MD of Alex Partners. And it was really interesting because he's ex-Disney, so he'd been coming here a long time, but obviously knows the business extremely well. And he had a whole message about really going back to the future and talking about all of the new opportunities that have come back around now, you know, because we know the market's not always easy, but there's new ways of working and new opportunities. And there's the whole sort of the rebirth of third party sales being back. So, you know, lots going on. I think people are learning to work a bit differently. We know that the TV industry is extremely resilient. And that's a message that has come through here really clearly.
And it's like shifting sands, isn't it, really? And obviously now we're going to be looking forward to MIP London. So what can you tell us about MIP London then?
Okay. So MIP London will be, well, first of all, it takes place on the 24th to the 27th of February in London with a pre-opening on the Sunday, 23rd. It will be a multi-genre international market, as we know how to do. Very focused on the market element and networking and screenings, with, of course, some editorial content. But the main focus is meetings and screenings and networking. We'll be opening the doors wide to all the buyers. We want buyers to attend by invitation. So we will be inviting all of the buyers who already obviously are at London TV screenings and BBC Showcase, because we will be running alongside, as well as the many more buyers who will be coming. Because, you know, let's sort of be honest here, we've still have 3,500 participants, including 1,200 buyers, who need a market at the beginning of the year. And our belief, through all of the feedback we've been getting over the past, you know, this has been going on, obviously, we've all known this has been going on, the congested calendar for a long time. And what we've been hearing for a long time is that the market's congested at the beginning of the year. There's too much going on. And the industry, the distribution industry, really has moved forward in the year to the end of February. So we've felt that by bringing a lot of what we can do, you know, which we know how to do, which is our market competence and organization, bring them up to February, we'll be offering an alternative venue for people who still need this business moment at the beginning of the year.
Who's it targeted at, MIP London? Because obviously there's a... It is an established event already, which is almost like a cooperative of large and some smaller distribution companies as well.
Sure.
So are you looking to bring in distributors that are not currently involved in London Screens, or are you looking to incorporate the ones that perhaps have already been established at London Screens for the last 2-3 years?
I think it's a mix, to be very honest, and it also totally depends on what people want to do. This is a complementary market. It's complementary to what already exists, which we know is very well established. And we all saw this year there were 29 distributors and 750 buyers, which was what the London TV screenings, you know, cooperative, as you said, communicated. So we already have, you know, companies who are already on that schedule who want to come and look at, actually, it might be better to sort of consolidate that in a different venue. And it's a lot of companies who don't have UK bases, who don't have, you know, the local events team. And, you know, let's not forget, we have, you know, relationships with hundreds of TV companies around the world who have started moving into involved in the London TV screenings moment already. I mean, I don't think, you know, this is happening with or without us, let's say. So we already know of lots of companies who are looking at going in. So now that we've announced that we're actually going to be offering a different, another opportunity and a consolidated venue hub where people can come and have meetings and some screenings. It's really open to all, but, you know, our plans have not been based on trying to take, you know, ask everyone who's doing their own London screenings events to come and do them with us. It's totally where some people have contacted us saying they're interested in that. But we do believe that we've already had a lot of conversations with others who are not there today who think that this could be a really good opportunity for them.
And is it going to be ticketed, or is it going to be, I mean, obviously buyers will be invited, as you say, to come, but will it also be ticketed for delegates to attend? Will they have to buy tickets for it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the way in which, you know, you can imagine we're at the Savoy Hotel and the IET at Savoy Place, which Central London West End venues, which I think for all of anyone listening will understand, those are very expensive venues to rent. You know, we will be looking to sell meeting spaces to companies who want to have a place where they can actually sit down and talk to buyers. We've got a couple of screening rooms where we will offer an alternative solution for companies who want to organize screenings. So, of course, we need people to pay for that. Otherwise, we couldn't be doing it. It's just we will be inviting all of the buyers free of charge. And we're having a lot of conversations while we're in Cannes. And, you know, we've done a big presentation so that all clients kind of start understanding a bit more clearly. Because I think a lot of people have ideas of what it's going to be. So it's good to have had the opportunity to clarify some of our messages whilst we've been here.
So it's goodbye to MIP TV, but not, of course, goodbye to Cannes, because MIPCOM is obviously the huge and probably growing market, I would imagine. Yeah. It seemed to be almost back to its, you know, heyday last year. Anything you can tell us? It's a bit early, I know, but anything you can tell us at this point about MIPCOM?
Well, I think the main thing about MIPCOM Cannes, you know, for us, it is our flagship event. As you said, it's the most important. It's what we hear from our clients every day, is that it is the most, it's the biggest, it's the most important, it's the most impactful for our clients' business. And we take that responsibility extremely seriously, that therefore we really do need to deliver that very strong market. It allows us now, you know, having just one event in Cannes, all of our energies here on the Croisette can be absolutely focused on delivering the best possible event. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, what I can say, as you say, it's early in terms of the real sort of planning, but we've been, you know, this is an ongoing process. We're working on MIPCOM all year round anyway. I mean, all of the people you'd expect to be there are already either kind of already confirmed or we're working with them. So it's going to be, yes, it's going to be a very big and important moment, I think, in everyone's calendar.
Lucy, I know you've got to shoot off. You're going to the Sustainable Development Goals Awards right now, aren't you? I won't delay you any longer. Thanks so much for speaking to me.
Thank you so much, Justin. It's great to speak to you.
Well, that's about it from our very last show from MIP TV in Cannes. Don't forget to subscribe to Telecast on YouTube for the latest content industry videos. Telecast was produced by Spirit Studios. On next week's show, we have Little Dot Studios Managing Director of Entertainment, James Loveridge, as he explains why broadcasters and rights holders should be on YouTube if they're not already. Until then, stay safe.